Looking at another question from Jesus that he asked this morning, he asks in Mark 8, he asks us, why does this generation seek a sign? Now, Mark writes his gospel for a Roman audience. We as Americans may feel, and I feel we should feel, that he's speaking directly to us. Mark doesn't have any time for genealogies and baby pictures and family background. He's got places to go and he's got people to see. Mark starts with the intrigue of John the Baptist. 10 verses in, we see the heavens being torn open in view of Jesus' baptism. And by verse 13, Jesus is battling Satan in the wilderness in the midst of wild beasts and in the view of angels. In Mark, the action comes heavy and it comes often. We gain vision of the power Jesus wields when a storm on the Sea of Galilee cowers before him. A demon named Legion begs for mercy before him being cast into a herd of swine. And men and women, deaf, blind, and mute, are healed at the hands of Jesus. Jesus' authority is on display, refusing adherence to man-made traditions, opposing the foolish tyranny of the religious elite, and forgiving the sins of a man lowered through a roof. All this action and lack of downtime between episodes appeals to a Roman audience. It appeals to an American audience. You see, Mark is making this effort to bring the good news to the Romans, his intended audience, his initial audience, in order to show them the truth of the cross. The Romans regarded crucifixion as the ultimate disgrace. Gundry, in his commentary on Mark, gives this quote from Cicero, the Roman senator. Cicero says, "The very word cross should be far removed not only from the person of a Roman citizen, but also from his thoughts, his eyes, and his ears. For it is not only the actual occurrence of these things or the endurance of them, but also the liability to them, the expectation, even the mere mention of them, that is unworthy of a Roman citizen and a free man." Rome hated the cross. It was a cruel and disgusting display of punishment that they would inflict on other people, but they refused to make a Roman citizen subject to. And the biggest problem, though, with the Roman view of crucifixion is that it impairs an accurate view of Jesus. The general Roman populace would have seen Jesus, having been crucified, as weak and shameful. In America, where rugged individualism is idolized and the shake-it-if-it-feels-good mentality is embraced, the suffering Savior who teaches us to turn the other cheek is often seen as weak and shameful. Mark writes his gospel to reveal Jesus in his power and in his authority. Mark writes his gospel to show Jesus' cross not as a place where a fragile human being hung, having been punished for his unsavory deeds, but where a courageous man's man willingly advanced to bear the burden of an entire world. In our text this morning, we will encounter this question, why does this generation seek a sign? We'll be in Mark 8, 1 to 21 this morning. It's going to be the episode, The Feeding of the 4,000. The lesser known of the feedings. Perhaps you find yourself looking for a sign from God today. Possibly you have decisions surrounding your health or an illness that you need to make. Maybe there is some resolution concerning your job that you need to come to. Perhaps there is a question of action or inaction related to a particular relationship that you're involved in. We will see how our willingness to bring ourselves under Jesus' power and authority impacts our ability to see his signs. We will see how to do it right. We will see how to do it wrong. And we will see, I think, how we tend to do it most often. First, we look at, and if you're taking notes today, a lot of you have your heads down. I'm wondering if you're taking notes. If you're taking notes, I want you to strike out that first line, and I want you to write in its place, "Those who submit to Jesus' authority will witness the signs of Jesus' authority." We see in the first three verses of Mark chapter 8, "In those days there was again a large crowd, and they had nothing to eat. He called the disciples and said to them, 'I have compassion on the crowd because they've already stayed with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, and some of them have come a long distance. We see here that Jesus shows care for those who submit to his authority. More than likely, when Jesus called these people and they decided to get up and go from wherever they were at, they took some food with them. They stayed with them for 3 days, the text tells us. And we can imagine that if we took 3 apples with us, when we're going to see Jesus, and at the end of the first day, we've got 2.5 of those apples gone, we're starting to get a little concerned, right? We're starting to wonder if Jesus is going to wrap this thing up by the time I get through this last half of this last apple. We can see, and we do see in the Old Testament, that the Jewish people, the Israelites, the Hebrews, they are pretty good about pitching a fit when they're hungry, right? We see that they don't have enough food, and then when they do have enough food, they don't like the food that they have, and they're pretty vocal. The Bible is pretty good about recounting the events of people who are dissatisfied with their food situation. But here we see this Roman audience has been with Jesus for 3 days, and they have nothing to eat, and you don't hear a peep out of them. We don't hear any complaining at all from the Romans. And I have to believe that's because they're dependent on Jesus. They've come to see Jesus. They know that they're out of food, and they've got everything. They've got all their cards, all their eggs in Jesus' basket. They're relying wholly upon him. They have given him authority over their lives, and they recognize the power with which Jesus operates. I think if we did not see that, again, the Bible is not shy about recounting these issues that the people bring to their leaders. You know, the people are not okay that they don't have any food, but they're not griping about not having any food. They're not tempted to make a big deal of this. But there was one at one time who tempted Jesus with this idea of not having any food. You might remember that when Jesus was in the wilderness, he was tempted by Satan. And Satan tells him, "Well, if you're God, go ahead and turn these stones into bread so that you can feed yourself." And Jesus tells him, "Man must not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." Here I think we see with this crowd of 4,000 that they have identified with Jesus in this statement, that they recognize and understand we don't have any bread left, but we're going to proceed and depend on Jesus when every word that comes out of his mouth. That's where our hope is. Jesus has compassion on the crowd we see, and he recognizes the difficulty they have in coming to him. Look, he says, "If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, and some of them have come a long distance." Jesus recognizes that in order to come to him, some of us travel a long distance. Some of us, it's pretty easy. My testimony is I was saved at 8. I knew Jesus from the time I was 8 years old until the time I'm 38 today. It's been pretty easy. It's not been that hard for me to get to Jesus, but I know that's not the case for a lot of people in this room. I know they've had big struggles in coming to Jesus, and Jesus recognizes that. Jesus recognizes that you have your family of origin issues. He knows those of you who had a father who didn't act like a father ought to act, and he knows those of you who had a mother who didn't act like a mother ought to act. He knows those of you who have had authority figures in your lives that you've suffered abuse at the hands of. He knows all of you and the mistrust you must have to one who claims authority over a world that's embroiled in pain and suffering. Jesus recognizes and he has compassion over the fact that you went a long time to get to him, but he invites you to trust him anyway. He invites you to submit to his power and his authority anyway. Because what he does when you do, Jesus shows miracles to those who submit to his authority. Verses 6 to 9. "He commanded the crowd to sit down on the ground. Taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before the crowd, before the people. So they served them to the crowd. They also had a few small fish, and after he had blessed them, he said these were to be served as well. They ate and were satisfied. Then they collected 7 large baskets of leftover pieces. About 4,000 were there, and he dismissed them." You see, Jesus will meet your need in ways that you don't expect him to. You see, Jesus, in the verses 4 and 5 here, the disciples are griping to Jesus that they don't have any food. Again, same as the last time they fed thousands of people with a sack lunch. He's like, Jesus, we don't have any food. And Jesus asks them, he's like, well, how many loaves do you have? And they say 7. And no doubt in my mind that the disciples see these 7 loaves and they're like, okay, I see these 7 loaves. And I know historically we eat the 7 loaves and we're satisfied, right? But I don't really understand how we're going to feed 4,000 men plus all the women and children with these 7 loaves. Jesus, how are you going to do this? And Jesus says to them, I'm going to do this thing in a way that you don't expect. And so he gives thanks and he breaks the bread and he blesses it. And it's funny to me. The Greek here says, it says that the disciples served them to the crowd, but that Jesus, taking the 7 loaves, he gave them to his disciples. Not that he gave them once, but that he keeps giving. The Greek tells us, the verb that the Greek uses is he's giving continuously. And so Jesus is taking this one loaf of bread, right? And it just keeps getting given and given. But there's still the bread there, right? He just keeps giving and giving and giving and giving. And we see there that the needs are met in ways we don't expect. And we also see, then they collected 7 large baskets of leftover pieces. And he says that they ate and they were satisfied. And the Greek here in satisfied means they were full. They had enough fish and they had enough bread so that their bellies were full when they were done. And we see again, just as in the feeding of the 5,000, we got baskets and buckets full of bread left over. We see that Jesus will meet your need to a degree that you could not imagine. The crowd of 4,000 shows us how we can expect to encounter the signs of Jesus when we will bring ourselves under his authority. Our friends, the Pharisees, show us what happens when we refuse to acknowledge the authority and the power of Jesus. The second note you're going to scribble out and rewrite says, those who refuse Jesus' authority will be denied the sign they demand. In verses 11 to 13, the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, demanding of him a sign from heaven to test him. Sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, why does this generation demand a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation. Then he left them, got back into the boat, and went to the other side. We see the Pharisees' refusal of Jesus' authority in the way they deal with him here in this very short encounter. The Pharisees, we see at the very beginning of 11, the Pharisees came, and the first thing they do with Jesus is they argue with him. You know, they have their own ideas, the Pharisees do, about how things ought to be done. They don't want to see Jesus forgiven sins, as he did in chapter 2 when the man was lowered through the roof. And Jesus says this man's sins are forgiven and his body is healed and he gets up and he takes up his mat and he gets out of there. The Pharisees don't want to see that. They don't believe in eating with sinners as Jesus did in Mark chapter 2. When Jesus tells them, I didn't come to save the righteous, but I came to heal the sick. They don't want to see any healings on the Sabbath. In Mark chapter 3, Jesus is in the synagogue, and the man with the withered hand stands before he and the congregation. And Jesus asks the Pharisees, should I heal this man's hand on the Sabbath? And they remain quiet. They don't say a thing because they know they're trapped. They know Jesus. Jesus has got them. And Jesus heals the man's hand despite the hardness of the Pharisees' hearts. They're going to argue with Jesus. This is their MO, the way they've been operating this whole time, because they have their own ideas about how things ought to be done. The Pharisees demand a sign from Jesus, showing us that the Pharisees have a disdain for Jesus. I don't know how it works with you guys, but whenever I see people who demand things from each other, the look on their face is typically not a pleasant one. If I watch my children and one of them says to the other one of them that I really want this thing, most of the time I can see the picture of their faces before I even look at them. I just hear the words and I'm like, I know what that face looks like, right? They've got disdain for one another when they demand that the other one do something for them. We see here that the Pharisees hate Jesus. And while those who are hated may be able to impose their authority and power physically over those who hate them, they will never exercise authority over the hearts of those who hate them. The Pharisees hate Jesus and abhor any thought of his authority over them. We see here that the Pharisees test Jesus, and in testing, they only look for proof of their unbelief. The Pharisees are not coming to meet Jesus on the side of the Sea of Galilee today on a beautiful, bright, sunny day so that they can have pleasant and civil discourse with Jesus about how things operate and who Jesus is and who God is. That's not why they're here. They come to Jesus so that they can test Jesus. They demand a sign from heaven from Jesus, which is interesting because if you've read the first seven chapters of Mark, you can see that Jesus has already given them signs on earth of who he is. In that episode in Mark chapter 3, when the man with the withered hand is in the synagogue, Jesus heals his hand, right? Because he's Jesus and he loves these people, and the Sabbath is for man, man's not for the Sabbath, right? Jesus has authority over the Sabbath to do whatever he wants. He's Jesus. And then when he does this, the end of that section says, and then the Pharisees sought to seek how they might destroy him. And later down in that chapter, we see when Jesus is confronted again with the Pharisees, they say, yeah, you have power to heal these things, but the only power you've got is from Satan. That's what the Pharisees tell Jesus. Yeah, you've got authority, but it comes from the devil. And Jesus, like he does, makes them look foolish, and he tells them, you knuckleheads know better that if I had the power over the devil and I was trying to conquer the power of the devil, there wouldn't be any power in the devil, right? The house divided will not stand, Jesus tells them. And then they hush up and they go about their way. And in testing Jesus, we see a picture of another who tested Jesus. In Matthew 4, verses 5 to 7, we read this. Then the devil took him to the holy city, had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels orders concerning you, and they will support you with their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Jesus told him, it is also written, do not test the Lord your God. You see, we can recognize that just like Satan did when he tried to tempt and test Jesus, that Satan's not all about having Jesus' authority or recognizing his power. He is in rebellion to Jesus, the same way that these Pharisees are. When we test Jesus, and in the testing of Jesus, the Pharisees reveal their refusal of his authority over them. You know, Jesus grieves the hard-hearted, these Pharisees, but he will not oblige them. Jesus would love for those who were in prime position to shepherd the hearts of his people Israel to be used by the God that they claim to worship, but they refuse Jesus' authority, and it grieves his heart. Though Jesus is grieved, he will not be used as some secular magician to put on a show for a bunch of people who have no interest in giving their lives to him. He won't do it. We see that Jesus asks, why does this generation demand a sign? And they demand a sign because though they have witnessed his authority before, they will not recognize the miraculous power and the authority which Jesus ought to wield and rightly wields and should be given to him, because they refuse to live under his authority. Because the Pharisees refuse Jesus' authority, Jesus refuses their demand for a sign. If we argue with Jesus, if we disdain Jesus, if we test Jesus, if we tell Jesus who he has to be, then we are foolish to expect a sign from Jesus. So we've seen the authority the crowd of 4,000 offers Jesus and the miracles that they witness. We've seen the disdain and lack of authority the Pharisees offer Jesus and the lack of signs that they witness. Now let's look at our last and most readily identifiable group this morning and how they operate in relation to Jesus' authority. These are the disciples. And we see, and this is verse 3, in that those who are ignorant of Jesus' authority do not recognize the signs that they are given. Picking up in verse 14. The disciples had forgotten to take bread and had only one loaf with them in the boat. Then he gave them strict orders. Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. They were discussing among themselves that they did not have any bread. Aware of this, he said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you don't have any bread? Don't you understand or comprehend? Do you have hardened hearts? Do you have eyes and not see? Do you have ears and not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of leftovers did you collect?" 12, they told him. "When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full of pieces did you collect?" 7, they said. And he said to them, "Don't you understand yet?" You know, we see those who follow Jesus do not necessarily allow his authority over their lives. We see the disciples, and the Gospels are full, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, of examples of how the disciples operate. And we look at them and we kind of laugh at them sometimes. I call them knuckleheads a lot of times, right? But how the disciples operate vastly different than how you and I are operating today? Because when we look at the disciples as just Larry, Moe, and Curly, and we just laugh at them, and we don't deal with how they mirror and reflect our actual lives, we miss the points that are in Scripture here. Just because Jesus told them to come and follow me does not mean that he's Lord over their lives. Here we talked about the feeding of the 5,000, and we don't record anything at the end of that event that says, "Wow," you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they don't sit back and say, "Look at what Jesus had done. Hail the Messiah. Hail Jesus who has come to save us," right? And they should. He just fed 5,000 plus people with a sack lunch, right? There should be some awe there, right? There should be something to get excited about. We don't see anything. He heals the Syrophoenician woman who comes and says, "Yeah, even Lord, I'm just a dog, but even the dogs get to eat from the crumbs under the kids' table," right? And we hear nothing from the disciples. He heals blind people. He heals deaf and mute people. He feeds another 1,000 people with a sack lunch. And we have no recognition from the disciples that he's anything other than a super cool dude to hang out with, right? Jesus is pretty cool. I got to tell you, if I'm in my job 9 to 5 and I see a guy that's healing people, bringing people up from the dead, feeding 10,000 plus people with 2 sack lunches, Carrie might be mad at me, but we're not going to pay our bills because I'm going to drop everything that I'm doing and I'm going to go hang out with that guy. I mean, you have to, right? But just because I'm going to go hang out with Jesus does not mean I've given my life over to Jesus. Those who follow Jesus do not necessarily allow his authority over their lives, and they miss the miracles that are there to be seen. Those who are ignorant of Jesus' authority resemble those who despise Jesus' authority. In 17, Jesus says, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Don't you understand or comprehend? Do you have hardened hearts? Do you have eyes and not see? Do you have ears and not hear?" These are quotes from a section of the Old Testament there, but also that we see in the New Testament describing the Pharisees. I mean, you've got Jesus right in front of you, but you've got eyes to see. You see Jesus healing this man's withered hand, but you don't give your life to him. You hear him on the Sermon on the Mount giving the most incredible sermon that's ever been written, and yet it does nothing to move their hearts to recognize him as deity, as the one and only Son of God. And the point that should bother us or should cause us to pay attention here just a little bit is the disciples aren't the bad guys, right? The Pharisees are the bad guys. We all know that the Pharisees are the bad guys. Every time we open the book and we read the book and we see the capital P followed by the heresies, we know those are going to be the villains, right? But what should bother us is the disciples who are not the bad guys because of their ignorance of Jesus' authority look like the bad guys. Jesus says, "Are you hard-hearted? Do you not have eyes to see and ears to hear?" When we're ignorant of Jesus' authority, we look like the bad guys. We look like the Pharisees in Jesus' eyes. We see that those who are ignorant of Jesus' authority do not recognize the signs Jesus works in their lives. Again, in verses 18 to 21, "When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of leftover did you collect? 12. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you collect? 7. Don't you understand yet?" Jesus asked them. When we are ignorant of Jesus' authority, we're not going to recognize the things that Jesus does in our lives. I asked you guys earlier if you've got relationships that are a struggle with you. I asked you earlier if you have work situations that are a struggle. I asked you earlier about the struggles that you have. Are you at the end of your rope in those struggles? I mean, do you really, are you at the point, or have you been at the point where you just cry out to God, Lord, I know who you are. I love you. I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing today in this specific situation, right? Have you reached the end of your rope where you need Jesus to tell you where to go and what to do? If you're there and you're not hearing Jesus talk to you about where you're supposed to go, the question that you need to be asking yourself is, have I given Jesus the authority over my life to do the thing that needs to be done? Or am I just sitting back and just waiting for Jesus to change his mind enough that he's going to agree with the way I want to live my life? Lord, I'm suffering right now, but you know, I really want you to relieve this suffering. I mean, I can't stand with this suffering anymore. And I love you, and I hope, you know, I'm doing your will. We'll say to God out of our mouths. But I'm done suffering. I'm going to go ahead and wait and hang out until you're going to help me get through this suffering because I'm done with it. Have we given Jesus the authority in our lives that we would suffer for him? Because if we haven't, the point of all of this today is that if we want Jesus to work in our lives, we've got to give him authority over our lives. We've got to recognize the power and the glory that Jesus Christ is rightly attributed to him. Jesus asks, why does this generation seek a sign? And it's a good question, and I think there's many answers to why this generation seeks a sign. But the premise behind that is, are you able to recognize the signs that Jesus gives you having accepted his authority and having recognized his power? Because if the answer is no, if you don't love Jesus, if you disdain Jesus, if you're mad at Jesus, and you get mad at Jesus and you say, Jesus, I need a sign, don't expect Jesus to give you a sign. Jesus isn't going to do that. He's not going to give you some magic trick so that you can just be happy with whatever answer you get. Do you get up in the morning because you want Jesus to be glorified? Do you seek relationships that are painful and awkward and man, you just wouldn't really deal with those people, but that person doesn't know who Jesus is. And when that person goes to hell without him, when that person dies without Jesus, they're going to hell. Does that motivate you this morning? Have you recognized the power that Jesus has over your life? Are you just happy to be ignorant? Are you just happy to be in the boat with him and watch him walk on water, not having given your life to him? I want to challenge you this morning. If you need a sign from Jesus, check your heart and see, have I given Jesus authority over my life to do what Jesus would do in my life?